Today on Rockin' the Suburbs,
our friend Mike Wagner sets up an interview for us with Steve Gorman, the drummer from the Black Crowes.
Cool. You know what this means.
What?
We have a new talent booker for our show.
Okay, Patrick, the podcast patron episodes just keep growing and getting bigger and bigger in stature and scope. And let's just get right into this here. This show is Rockin' the Suburbs. I'm Jim Lenihan.
And I'm Patrick Foster.
And with us is our friend, listener, and podcast patron, Mike Wagner. Hello, Mike.
Hello, gentlemen.
And Mike invited a special guest, so I'm going to leave it to him. He can introduce this person. I know he's been really excited about this interview. And so, Mike, tell us who is on the show, and then you can just kick us off with this interview, all right?
Fantastic. With us today is Steve Gorman. You will know him as the drummer from the Black Crowes. Listeners of the podcast and our Friday Night Hootenanny know I'm a huge Black Crowes fan, and not just because Steve's here. I love drummers. And Steve is absolutely one of my favorite drummers. I did a guest episode 2-3 years ago, and it was just sort of a quick flyover for the Black Crowes, and I mentioned Steve's drumming on there. And when his book came out, I read it, I loved it, and I reached out to him, and he was kind enough to join us today. And I extend my thanks to you, Steve, for joining us, and this is a really great fun for us.
I am happy to be here. Thanks for asking.
So before we get going in, Mike, I do want you to ask the first official question, but let me ask the first unofficial question, because this came up just now before we started recording, which is that, Steve, you said your daughter goes to Indiana University. Is that right?
My son goes to Indiana University.
Okay. All right.
That's a fact.
All right. That's my alma mater. So,
And what year did you graduate?
89. So we didn't exactly cross paths.
I put everything in hoops terms. I'm just thinking about who was playing. If you'd said 81, I would have been very impressed.
You know about Keith Smart, right? You know about Keith Smart and the shot, right?
I just moved to Atlanta in 87. I watched that game on a black and white TV with Sven Pippian, the two of us. He couldn't have cared less, but he did enjoy the ending. He was excited for the last play, so I remember it very well.
I was at school then. I was a sophomore. And it's very exciting to be able to, you know, experience a national championship when you're actually, like, you know, in school at that time. You know, that was a wonderful thing. And I remember all of that in great detail. I don't remember much that came after.
Right.
If you get what I mean. But anyway. Yeah,
I do.
But anyway, that's great. So another Hoosier. That's awesome. You're beautiful.
Doing my small part to keep the Hoosier family feeling good. It's going to come back, man.
So go ahead, Mike.
Now that the unofficial business is out of the way,
right.
Mike. Yeah,
that's right.
Just to set up, I think most people are familiar with the Black Crowes' early success with Shake Your Moneymaker. And then you guys made an outstanding second album, one of my favorite albums ever is Southern Harmony, A Musical Companion. And you write eloquently about that in the book, and it's really great. And I can't recommend the book enough to listeners. It's really fantastic. But there was a paragraph here that you wrote that I kind of want to talk to you about and kind of get your take about it. This is what you write. The problem with the Black Crowes, and this will always drive me crazy, is that we weren't some hard rock. We weren't some hard luck story like Big Star or The Replacements. If you were Alex Chilton or Paul Westerberg, people look at you and say, man, they should have had bigger careers, but we had a big career. And we had a big time manager who knew how to maintain it, and then we threw it away. And I was just like, I was heartbroken reading that statement, because I was wondering, like, I guess the question is like, is there anything that could have been done at that time to mitigate what happened? And like, what did you want the Black Crowes to be? What is it that if you could? I know you say you wouldn't change anything, but sorry, please.
No, to mitigate or change it. I mean, the answer is The ultimate answer is no. I mean, everybody was who they were, and everybody handled what had been thrown at us and the way they handled it. If anything could have been different, it would have been, for me personally, it would have been my being willing to learn and educate myself about what I was actually dealing with. And I probably would have, if I could go back and change anything. The only things I could change, I eventually did, which is me. It's all about how I perceive things, and it's all about what I was willing to admit about not only myself, but my bandmates and our situation. You know, if you had said to me in 1993 that you guys are about to throw your career away, I would have laughed at you and said, that's not going to happen. Even with red flags lining up in front of me, it's really hard to admit, you know. So,
right.
But what I wanted the band to be, we were certainly that band for a few years. I mean, the simplest way to say it is, I just thought the band should have always been able to acknowledge our strengths and then work to our strengths. And I think the band had a real hard, it was very difficult to do. I think that Chris Robinson saw working to your strengths as weakness, or that would lead a band to repeat themselves. Mm-hmm. That was never anything I wanted to do. I didn't want to keep re-recording records that just because they worked. But I just think that like I like a lot of the music we made in the mid-90s. But I wouldn't say it's great. It's not us at our best. You know what I mean? I appreciate it. We worked hard, and I like the result. But there's moments to me that I think it was pretty obvious that everybody's doing some. We're all on the same page. Bands are 99% chemistry,
right?
You know, like the Black Crowes could have easily. Any band can go get someone to write their songs and just play parts and get some, you know, hit makers in there and. That was nothing. There was never anything interesting about that to me. I think that we became one of those great bands that was just what it was. Like, we couldn't be anything but the Black Crowes. That started to happen around 1991 in the original lineup. You know, touring the first album for almost 2 years. By the time that album ended, we were a really, really formidable rock and roll band.
Yes,
and
absolutely.
Then, and we had picked up Ed Harsh. And then when Mark Ford joined the band, that was the final piece that just put us over the top. This was a world level top shelf rock and roll band from the end of 91 until really that lineup, you know, through 97. Now within that, I think we had a lot of times where we weren't playing to our strengths, and we were good enough where we could still be pretty damn good, you know. But I think that Southern Harmony and the tour that followed, and then the tour for Amorica, I think more often than not we were breathing the rare air. Like, this was a rock band doing what it's supposed to do. Everybody's on the same page. And it's an extra, you know, you have six guys on stage, but there's this seven, there's the extra element, you know, the 12th man, if you prefer, you know, something way greater than the sum of the parts would take over. And that band was incredibly special. Moving away from that and trying to dismantle that was not something that we were that was ever going to work. And it's real easy to say that in hindsight. That's why I say all this stuff. It's easy to say now. And it's also easy to say that it was impossible to see in real time for various reasons. But I think that the results speak for themselves. I think you can hear a lot of the music the band made over the years and go, man, that's undeniably a good band. That's really something. And then you can put something on and say, that's just beyond description. That's unquantifiably, that's as good as a band can be. That's a band doing what they're supposed to be doing. And it was those lines that were never adhered to, you know, we would, you know, the reason we could pull ourselves right out of the ditch every time was, well, we were great, you know, but
right. You would get on stage and everything would be like, it would just like kick in, right?
Yeah. I was more interested in avoiding the ditch to begin with.
Yeah.
You know,
I noticed one of the bits when you were talking about when you went to make Amorica. I don't know if most people know this, but you actually recorded an album called Tall. It was for lack of a better word, in the can. Yep. And then you abandoned it, correct?
Yes. Yes.
And then that turned into Amorica, right?
Yeah.
Right,
we went in and re-recorded Amorica. Well, we didn't rework the recordings for Tall. It's an entirely separate set of recordings from a different studio at a different time. I think probably more than half of Amorica had been recorded for Tall, but okay. The tracks are very different. There's an entire different energy and vibe between the two. I think it was definitely it was the right decision was to go in. We made a better record the second time around for sure.
And you mentioned in the book that a lot of fans actually do regard that as your best album. You sort of alluded to like having the cover that you had actually hurt the album sales quite a lot, right? Yeah, I mean, it's like...
Oh, it's terrible. It's the stupidest thing ever. I mean, there was a lot of decisions that happen in bands are the result of interpersonal relationships and dynamics, and there's a million building blocks to this one decision.
Right,
but you can look back and see it and go, well, that was years in the making, or that was just part of the album cover is a real simple one to look back and go... That makes a strong case for the dumbest thing the band ever did.
Just for those who don't know, it was basically the cover of a Hustler magazine.
It was the July 1976 bicentennial cover for Hustler magazine. That issue. It's an American flag bikini with pubic hair sticking out of the top. And so, to put that on an album cover at a time when we had had great success with the first album. Half that success numbers-wise anyway on the second album in the States, we had made a record that that was not at all concerned with trying to keep up with trends at radio. We made the record we wanted to make. Amorica's a standalone, fantastic record. That's where the band was in 1994. And I always had a very – and granted, I'm not the quote songwriter. I'm not the guy writing the lyrics or the melody or the riffs, but that doesn't mean those aren't my songs.
Right.
My perspective on this is if we go in and make a record that's done for all the right reasons, which is we wrote the songs we wanted to write. We recorded the record we wanted. It's our statement of who we are as a band right now. Well, then I do want to take that and put it in as many ears as possible in the world.
Yes, absolutely.
I'm not interested in having a bunch of radio analysts come in and listen to five songs and say, if you change the lyrics on that chorus, you'll have a hit. Now, we never did anything like that. Like, we didn't have commercial... We didn't concern ourselves with what we thought would get us on MTV or on radio. We just made the records that we wanted to make. The first record found all of that because our producer, we'd never made a record. We had a great producer. We listened. He did have his eye on rock radio. He did think about hooks and catchy choruses. And he was thinking about all those things. We weren't even aware that, he manipulated us perfectly. And I don't mean that in a bad way. He got us to put these great ideas on tape. And we made a record that was way beyond what the band was capable of. The second album, we followed up more of a band. Okay, now we're actually this band we always wanted to be. Let's go in and Southern Harmony is going to be this great leap forward, a great progression. Well, by the time we're making Amorica, the landscape of our early success had changed entirely at radio. It had changed entirely at MTV. So those tools had shifted. But that's the music industry. Every 2 years, it's a whole different set of expectations for what rock radio is. Now in 1994, you had alternative rock radio was killing old AOR stations. Suddenly it was Smashing Pumpkins and Nirvana and Pearl Jam, and anything from the 80s or even early 90s like us was passé. So we didn't go into Amorica thinking we've got to keep up with Stone Temple Pilots and Alice in Chains and Pearl Jam or Smashing Pumpkins. We just made the record we wanted to make. So I felt very good about that. I never was concerned about the validity of that music. That said, now let's go see if we can find as big an audience as possible. I mean, we put our heart and souls into it. So all this to say, to then put a photo on the cover of the album that's going to immediately mean it's not sold at Walmart or Best Buy or Target. Mm-hmm. It's just, you're just shooting yourself in the foot for literally no reason. If there'd been a grand concept for why that needed to be the album cover that anybody else in the band could have understood and gotten behind, again, if I thought it was a great idea and I understood the meaning of it, right, and I thought that furthered the message of the record, man, damn the torpedoes. But that wasn't the case. It's not just that. It's not just, oh, it had pubic hair and Target and Walmart wouldn't stock it. It had pubic hair, Target and Walmart wouldn't stock it, and no one understood why we were even doing it. There was nothing to sink your teeth into for the rest of the band. And I say in the book, it speaks to everyone's dysfunction that even happened when nobody was aligned with the idea beyond Chris and the person at the label. So it was in a lot of ways, it spoke to just how much of a mess we'd already become that four or five guys in a band are going, dude, I don't dig this. And it didn't matter. We were overruled.
And as a fan, you're listening to it and you're like, this is great. This is a great, great album. And I've actually, with fans of the podcast, I've like told them, like, go back and listen to that album. That is a great album. And it's not Shake Your Money Maker. It's not. But like, man, the grooves are just, like, I think you said it in the book. It's like the playing was is about as intense as you guys ever recorded on album, actually, in some respects, mm-hmm. right? And it just,
yeah,
and you listen to it and you're like, why is this? You know, anyway, sorry.
Well, it was just a huge disservice was done with that album cover, you know, and then there was a problem. The first single, in hindsight, it's easy to say this again, so I will. The first single clearly should have been Wiser Time. But you know, the people whose job it is at the record company to pick the single because they're the ones talking to radio, you know, you're dealing with a lot of people with no imagination. You're dealing with people who take the safe choice every time. A Conspiracy was the one song on that album that you could have imagined having been on Southern Harmony, the vibe of the song anyway. And I mean, I get the thinking behind all those things, but we didn't have... again, we just weren't aligned and there wasn't enough cohesive thought. The band was already at each other's throats when it came time to make these really very important creative decisions. And it's very short-sighted. You know, I always used to say, if you don't want to be a one-hit wonder, better have some more hits. You know, for that reason alone, I just don't want to be a one-hit. I don't want people to come up to me when I'm 40 and go, man, that Hard to Handle was amazing. Yeah. You know, if somebody says to Mick Jagger, I still love Satisfaction, it's like, okay, but there's 31 more you can throw out there that everybody knows, you know. Or, you know, you could, I mean, you just look at any band that's been around a long time, you would hope that there's a bunch of songs you can hang your hat on. And so, but again, that's just that's just the way I would have preferred it to go. And that's my thinking at the time. There were plenty of decisions I imagine everybody can look back on and go, well, I was on the wrong side of that one. You know, even things that work that I didn't think would work. I mean, there's everything in between. But there are very few things like that album cover that are just so clearly like, okay, now that was, in every possible respect, a mistake.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's kind of, in that sense, you're kind of like the Replacements, right? They were constantly sabotaging themselves.
We took a lot of pages from their book, you know. We just took the wrong ones.
Yeah,
I think, you know what I mean. It's like, yeah. And like I said, the Replacements weren't, you know, headlining Glastonbury on their second album, and we were.
Well,
you know, it's one thing to never get there. It's another thing to get there and then immediately start to set it on fire.
Right, this is the question I have though. Like, which would you rather have? Right? I mean, you guys did have huge success.
Listen, I don't look back on any of this. I mean, I've said this a bunch, but, you know, I look at the Black Crowes like we should have been an all-time 30, 40-year run. We could have been, you know, if you look at when you have that conversation about all the great American rock and roll bands, the long haulers. Like right now, you got Aerosmith and ZZ Top, the 50-year careers, right?
Yeah.
You know, I don't put the Eagles on that list, but you've got behind them, you've got Van Halen had their run, Metallica. You've got these 30 and 40, now the other bands from the 90s, Pearl Jam, that's 30 years in, you know, Foo Fighters are 25 years in, et cetera, et cetera. We should have been one of those bands, and we should have been one of those bands that got there and stayed there. I mean, we had the ability to be that band, and we did have the management piece, and we did have all of the elements, and most especially the chemistry. We had the indefinable, we had the intangibles, and we had the tangibles. Now, that's really rare.
Yeah.
But not having done that, like, it's like if we went to the Olympics in the 100 meters and we came in seventh, we're still fast.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Like, no doubt. Yeah.
We didn't get the gold medal. And in fact, we didn't even get bronze. But for a while there, we were the seventh fastest dude in the world. Yeah. We were bad. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I'm not looking back on all this with regret in the grandest of, as far as my life goes, I'm great. I don't lose sleep over this shit. But when you talk about looking back and saying, you know, we had something really special and we didn't manage to maintain it, you know, that, yeah, there's always a sadness there, but there's also full acceptance. I'm not,
right.
You know, I'm not still trying to make sense of it on any level. I get it. And when it was good, it was great. And when it was bad, it was still f-ing good.
Yeah.
Yeah. Steve, I want to say a couple things. One, man, I just love the book so much. And I tend to read a lot of these rock and roll books, but I'll tell you how I knew yours was really good, because I was just turning the pages like really, really fast. And all of a sudden I was like, how the hell did it get to me 2:30 in the morning? You know what I mean? I thought it was 8 o'clock when I laid down, but you know, I'm still reading this book.
Right on.
But it's really wonderful. And it to me, you know, it seems like it's going to stand as, this, you know, clear-headed version of like, just like you were talking about, of all these events that went down and were so, so interesting and do play, you know, as you said, a key part in American rock and roll history. But I'm curious about something. You know, I know a lot of musicians and most of them don't pay a ton of attention to reviews, but as an author now, did you go out and read reviews of the book when they came out, or like the Amazon reviews or any of that stuff? Did you pay attention?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, for a minute, you know, yeah, I just wanted to, you know, you get a sense right away. The first few Amazon reviews I saw were all really positive. And then I looked again a week later, and for a little while there, it was like every one of them was 5 stars. And I'm like, okay, well, that's the people who are going to rush out and buy the book.
Right.
And then the first time I saw a negative review, it was about literally about the book itself losing its binding. Like, it was about the actual physical book. Looking back now, it's funny, no one's asked me that. I probably was a little more nervous going into it than I would have ever admitted or than I would have acknowledged to myself. I try to keep a level head, and if I don't, I at least act like I am, because I know I'll get back to that point sooner than later.
Right.
By the time this thing came out, man, I'd read that book 6,000 times. You know
right,
what I mean?
Like, I imagine.
I wrote it. I wrote over 900 pages.
Wow.
And I turned it in, and I had the immediate thought of, this is 900 pages of pure gold. Don't move a word.
Right.
And the publisher wouldn't even read it. He goes, do you know what it costs to print a 900-page book? And, of course, that had never occurred to me. I was like, so you don't think an $86 price makes sense for a book about the Black Crowes?
Well, I want to ask this real quick, because I think one of the things I think makes this so good, and I'm with Patrick on this, it's like you just sort of devour it. It's definitely a page turner, but I've always had this theory, Steve, that the drummer has the best perspective on the band. And I mean that because, like, literally you see everything. When you're on stage, you have that vantage point where you see everything, and nobody else really quite has that. And I think that maybe in some way translates to offstage too, right? You're kind of a different person in the band than the rest of the band, right? So you kind of see things a little bit differently, right? And so does a drummer have this kind of unique perspective that lends itself to this sort of
I think that certainly can and should. You know, the drummer has the first option, if you will. Hmm. Now, I don't think Keith Moon took advantage of that.
No.
You know, but maybe he did. I mean, who knows? I mean, but you know, I think that there is a sense of, well, the way the Black Crowes operated, it's even more than just seeing all the things in a dynamic. I mean, the way we played music, you know, I always did look at it like I'm driving from the back seat.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
And if you want to put something into sports terms, when I was talking about chemistry before, you know, to me, I was always like, this is a basketball team. And when everybody remembers what they're here to do, we're great. You know, mm-hmm. Like, I don't shoot threes. I don't dunk. I get all the rebounds and I block shots and I throw outlet passes. I'm great with that. You know what I mean?
Yep.
We got Mark over here to shoot threes, and we got Chris to do windmill dunks, and then we got, you know, Rich is going to be the small forward or whatever you want to say, but everybody had a role.
Mm-hmm.
And when everybody understood what they were supposed to do, we were pretty undeniable. It was always a question of, it was more like a soccer mentality, which is if you look at two soccer teams, the team with the best player isn't necessarily going to win. It's the right team whose worst players are better than their worst players.
There you go. Right.
It's a bottom-up sport. And I always played sweeper in soccer, which is also, you're kind of running the show from the back of the field in a lot of ways. And so the way the band, you know, Rich and I were always the original rhythm section. I mean, the bass player, Johnny, when he joined the band, he had to figure out what we were already doing, because Rich and I learned how to play together. We spent 3 years as a local band. Just the only things we never played unless we were in the room with each other. You know, I wasn't getting at a drum kit with headphones and working on my rudiments. And he would be writing parts all the time, but he wouldn't ever play them at full volume unless I was in the room. Hmm. Like we literally learned how to play our instruments while learning how to play together. So we just had this thing from very early on that you can't recreate, that you can't simulate. It's a little different than two musicians who already know what they're doing meeting and saying, hey, let's click. And I've had that happen. You vibe with other musicians and it's great. But there's something about learning together that you just can't put – you can never get your arms around it fully. And I think we had that. And so everything from the Black Crowes, from my perspective, right or wrong, started with the rhythm section. And I include Rich in that.
There's a passage where you talk about – when you were on tour with the Stones, you're open up with the Stones, and you and Rich are watching Keith and Charlie play Monkey Man. And you're like looking at Keith and Charlie, which was, you know, Stones fans will know that there's a really special relationship between those two guys. And you're like, me and Rich have that. And you're thinking, like, you're going to it's kind of going back to what you were talking about. We're going to be one of these bands, and we're going to have this run, and we're going to be where the Stones are in third. Not where they are. I mean, not the Stones, maybe not touring that big, but you're going to have a special musical relationship for 30 years. And I was just like, because I was in a band and I had that relationship with the drummer, and it fell apart, and it just, like, it hurts. Any musician will tell you. Like when you have that special thing, and if you're lucky enough even to have it for,
of course,
6 months or whatever it is, it hurts. It hurts forever.
No, you're right. The context, the level of it doesn't matter if you're the Stones or if the band you were in. That's very true. You find something that you cannot recreate.
Yes,
and you hope that you understand it before it's gone. Oftentimes, that's not how it works. It's gone, and you realize how great it was because you took it for granted. That's something everybody can relate to in some way in their life. But for musicians, when you find that perfect thing where you're just always in sync with people, it's so precious.
You know, along those lines, one scene in the book that really stood out to me was, I think, correct me if I'm wrong here, I think it was when you went to Japan and you guys kind of had like this moment of like sort of an emotional breakdown.
Yeah, together. I certainly did.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. And then that opened the door for both Chris and Rich to also, you know, open up a little bit.
Yeah, I thought that was...
And have their own mini breakdowns.
Right. And I thought that was really compelling because what I took from that, it just seemed like it's great to have success, of course, but it felt to me like it was everything just going too fast, or like, you know, everything around you, because it's this big it becomes a big machinery very quickly, right? It goes 100 miles an hour.
Listen, it was never the external situation. It was always it was always in the bubble that it was going too fast.
Okay.
If somebody said, like when Southern Harmony came out, it debuted at number one. Shake Your Moneymaker never got to number one. Southern Harmony debuts at number one, but second week it's at number four. Third week it's at number nine. Like it did very well, but nothing like the first album. It did half the sales. That didn't bother me in the least. I was still able to go, wait, we sold 2.5 million copies? I don't care that the first one sold 5. 2.5 million records? That's insane. You know what I mean? Right. Like looking at the ticket sales, they were still great. They weren't maybe on the trajectory we expected, but everything like that was fine. MTV not playing the Thorn in My Pride video. I didn't lose sleep over that. You know, radio going to all these bands from Seattle. No one lost sleep over it. Now, it bugged us a little bit, but not enough to make us all, you know, worried about our place in the world. What ate me alive was watching the band you know, just the it was just us. It was, you know, I would have been way better served had I had the ability to just pull back and look at it like I say now, a band's a clown car. If you told me that in 1992, I would have been upset because we're all really bright guys. We're too smart to be this stupid. Like I used right. to think that all the time, you know. And I personally, my personal mindset on what's cool about being in a band, well, that's not the same as other guys in the band's mind. You know, everybody has different yeah. ideas of, because we're this huge band, let's do this. Well, those didn't always line up. And I really wish I could have just laughed at all the differences and been cool with it. Even though my bandmates couldn't. Like, everybody wanted everything to be, you know, it was too precious. Like, the band was like, everybody cared so much, you know.
Yeah.
And I used to say things like, you know, if you squeeze the puppy, you kill it. Gotta let it, gotta let it loose. But I was just as guilty as anybody. I couldn't get my head out of that either. So when things were going really, you know, outside the band, it looked great. Looks like, you know, we're flying to Japan, a country we've never been in, and we got 9 or 10 theater shows all sold out. You know, we're going to Australia. We've never been there. Every gig sold out. I mean, this is a great – we got a second album out. It's huge. But just watching everybody's – the way we were interacting together, and I just felt this incredible pressure from inside pushing out as opposed to outside. You know,
That's interesting. We
weren't – I didn't feel like we were imploding. I felt like we were exploding. The outside that bus didn't concern me.
So I had a question about the latter era with Luther Dickinson and Sven and Adam McDougall, because you didn't really write about that much, because I think the way you described it was it wasn't your band anymore, right?
It started off as, you know, there's this thing that's ours, and then there's this thing that's, well, it's there's a couple breaks, you know, from till 97, it was a band. And then after 97, it was a group. And then it was about to be a band again, maybe in 2005 and 6. And then after that, it was a group and a job. I never would have thought of it as a job before. But then I realized, well, I can stay in Nashville and play sessions, or I can be in a really good rock and roll band and tour the world and try to maintain the legacy of something that used to be my entire life.
Right. Mm.
And I looked around at the landscape and was like, that's a pretty fortunate place to be.
Right.
All things considered, you know. And so it was, you know, the legacy of the Black Crowes is still very important to me. It will always be. You know,
right.
And I don't have anything to do with it, but I know what I did when I could to do my best to make sure that was something that was would be looked back on fondly for generations. I mean, it's a big deal to me that music is still out there. You know, I talk about the day Shake Your Moneymaker was released, I was still working at a record store.
Hmm.
You know, on February 13th, 1990, I was putting my own album out in the bins that morning.
And wow.
That was an incredible feeling. You know, I was, on the one hand, I was like, I can't believe I'm still here. Like, I'm supposed to be a rock star. You know, what the hell is this? and then on the other side, I was putting it in the, you know, I'm in the section of Bs, you know, and there's the Beatles, and then there's Black Sabbath, and then there's just the random B, you know, where you don't get your own name tag yet. And it's like, there's still some great records in those random Bs, man. And record was in there. And that day, people were coming in and buying the album, and I'm ringing it up, and they have no idea that I'm a guy, that I'm in the band.
It was great.
I mean, I remember thinking like, if this is it, this is still great.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
That was fantastic. I mean, 3 years earlier, that record came out 1 week short of my 3-year anniversary of moving to Atlanta.
Wow.
I moved on February 20th, and that record came out February 13th. And so I was like, I got this thing in under the 3-year wire. Wow. I'm doing, because, you know, I bought my first drum kit, and I got a record in the stores in under 3 years.
That's amazing. Yeah.
So, you know, that it, as much as I lost my mind and a lot of perspective on things, I would think back to that and try to get it back and balance it. And now at 55 years old, I look back on that and I still remember, I can remember how that felt like it was now. And it's awesome. I mean, those things are, you know, those things are fantastic.
So before we go, can I ask you this, which is sort of the opposite of what you're feeling of what you're talking about right now, but I found it to be just one of the most endearing little stories in the book, which is that a few years after Shake Your Moneymaker, you guys decided to sort of kick back and relax one evening at a strip club, and and the stripper figures you guys are in a band or something like that, right? And you guys say you're in the Black Crowes, and she goes, "Oh yeah, my mom likes the Black Crowes."
Oh sure, right. That was 1996. We were only 6 years into our career.
Did that give you a new perspective on things?
Oh, there's always things like that. Yeah, I mean, trust me, when you know, there's a lot of things that happen that are, it's like the funniest nosebleed you ever had. You know what I mean? It's just like someone comes up and goes,
right.
But you have to laugh at the time. It's like, man, this is unbelievable. And that was definitely one of those. Shake Your Moneymaker came out in February 90. It went platinum. It took a year to go platinum. And then it just exploded, right? So 1990 was a slow build to a million records. And then it just went nuts. And it sold a million records a month for 3 straight months. You know, it's just going crazy. And then we left the country for the final 4 months of the tour. Well, during that time, Pearl Jam and Nirvana put records out. And they caught the fancy of a whole generation of fans. Like, we came home, and in that 4 months, it seemed like it was already over. Like,
wow.
The Black Crowes, that was last year, you know, or that was the spring. And now, and it was really largely because of Nirvana. Like, that just took off immediately. We got thrown into this classic rock, for lack of a better word, mindset within the industry.
Right.
And right on the heels, you know, the guys in Pearl Jam are our age, if not all older than us. Those bands in Seattle didn't plan this. They didn't see themselves as blood brothers, but they all drafted off each other for a good 3 solid years.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
It didn't take us years to realize the train had left the station. Like, we hadn't even gotten home from our first tour and it was already over.
Yeah.
Amazing. On a certain level.
Yeah.
The idea that we were the new thing. That's what I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, Steve Gorman, thank you very much for all of this time.
Thank you, man.
That was fantastic, Steve.
Wonderful.
Wonderful conversation.
Well, anybody that has the stones to actually call their podcast Rockin' the Suburbs, you gotta tip the cap there. So well done on that.
Thank you, man.
All right, so the book is Hard to Handle, The Life and Death of the Black Crowes, and everybody should go check that out. It's a great read. And thanks very much to Mike Wagner for setting this up.
Thank you, Mike.
Thank you, Steve. I really appreciate it. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you, fellas.
And as always, if anyone has comments on the topic, the Black Crowes, and you want to call in, we'll do a future episode with your comments. Call
612-440-1984.
Or email rock@suburbspod.com. Or find us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. All those at Suburbs Pod. Sorry, Steve, do you interact with people on the socials?
I do. On Twitter, mostly. That's SGSFOX. SGSFOX, which is from my old sports talk radio show.
Right.
Is where that came from. And I just... As soon as the guy who has Steve Gorman decides to cancel his account, I'm jumping all over it.
There you go. You deserve it.
He's never tweeted. He's just sitting on it for years.
That. Yeah.
Bastard.
Thanks again. It's Rock in the Suburbs. I'm Jim Lenihan.
I'm Patrick Foster.
With us has been Mike Wagner and Steve Gorman, and we'll talk to you all later.
See you, fellas. Cheers. if I'd been thinking ahead, I would have bugged the stage for just in between song conversations. That would be, if I could go back and do anything, it would just be to have a, you know, 90 minutes of what we were saying to each other in between songs. That would be the best thing ever.